Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is author Gerald Davis. He's a native West Virginian, but he now lives in Columbia. He's also an editor, an author, and he's a member of our ETV advisory board. And he has come out with a book entitled Algerian Diary, Frank Kearns and the Impossible Assignment for CBS News. Welcome to the Journal, Jerry.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's talk a little bit about you. West Virginia boy, how'd you end up in Columbia, South Carolina?
I married right.
Oh, that's a very short, good answer.
My late wife, Judy, was on the senior staff at Blue Cross, Blue Shield of South Carolina. And she had a job offer here, and she didn't like the offers that I had, which were on the West Coast. So she said, let's go east, and we did that.
And at that time, you were working for ETV in West Virginia?
No. I was I'd been working as a consultant for Hill & Knowlton, an international public relations and public affairs consulting firm in Chicago. And this was an opportunity for me to go out independently because I had a varied career, a very successful one, but it was varied nonetheless. I started out doing one thing, and I ended up doing several other things.
All right, well, what did you start out doing?
Well, I was going to be a documentary film director, and that got off to a great start and then hit a brick wall. And when I was in grad school, Frank Kearns was going to be the subject of my master's project. Little did I think at the time that somebody I knew so well because I had worked for him for 2 years as an undergraduate— that he'd turn me down. But I thought it was a layup. You know, I'll get film from CBS. He'll introduce me to friends and colleagues. I'll tell this wonderful little story and get out of grad school. And he turned the tables on me and said, go find another subject.
And this was specifically on the Algeria story?
No.
Just on him?
Just on him. Because I thought being a guy who grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia, and went to college there, and then after the war, World War II, he went to CBS News. And that was in the early days of CBS. And so I thought, well, given that he was ended up being the Africa bureau chief, and his real job was as a war correspondent, Africa, the Middle East, parts of Europe, that is a good story to tell there, one that would keep viewers interested. But he still said no. So after about 18 months, he finally said, get out of here, picked up the telephone and called his former cameraman, Joe Masraf, who lived in Paris, and said, I've got a guy to come working for you. And so I sold everything I had and took off for Paris. The deal was if I was there New Year's Day, 1977, that I would become part of the CBS News crew in Paris. It wasn't my plan, but the government of the United States decided to bomb Libya during that time. And so Joe took off and failed to tell anybody that this young guy from the United States was coming. And so I ended up kicking around Paris until the money started running out. And they sent me to London to work for 60 Minutes, but couldn't get me a working visa. And then they offered me Rhodesia as a stringer, and I had $250 in my pocket and a ticket home, and I said, I could go where war is about to break out and not do too well, or I can go home. So I did. I went home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it seemed a little safer, and I had no idea what I was going to do, but I ended up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, building a public radio station, and then working on public television, and then I got into corporate work. So it's been a varied career, agribusiness, insurance, managed care, and then consulting.
Okay. And you married well and came that brought you to South Carolina.
I did.
Okay. And you stayed.
I did.
This whole story about Frank Kearns is an interesting one. It does start in World War II, and I think we might give our listeners kind of a background because you refer to him as one of the Moro boys, Edward R. Murrow, reporting from London. And I think most historians of journalism would say that modern broadcast journalism in terms of bureaus and that kind of thing, news, really began with Murrow and the reporting from London.
That's correct. CBS, through Ed Murrow, covered World War II, the European theater, through a variety of bureaus, and they hired extraordinary journalists. Charles Collingwood was there. They had somebody in Paris. They had somebody in Berlin. You know, William Shire, who wrote the big books about pre-Nazi Germany and then the war, he anchored Berlin for them.
Eric Severide was one of them, wasn't he?
Eric Severide was part of the Murrow Boys. In fact, he ended up being best man in Kern's second marriage.
Okay. But now, was Shire actually in Berlin during the war?
He was there up until the war really got going.
Okay.
But they had people across Europe, and these were folks that had good experience as journalists, but not radio journalists. And so radio reporting really came into its own at that time.
During the war, Frank Kearns was with Counterintelligence Corps.
That's right. He was one of the first officers in the Counterintelligence Corps. He enlisted into the Motor Corps. He was going to fix cars. But they determined that he was a little smarter in certain ways than what they needed in the garages. And so they immediately tapped him to go into the police, the military police. And they stationed him in Washington, D.C., where he met a guy who would become very familiar to the Kearns story later on, a guy named Miles Copeland. Mm-hmm. And the two of them were really kind of scoundrel-like. They were to do missions around Washington looking for spies. And oftentimes, they went to baseball games.
Well, wasn't Eichelberger eventually part of that crowd?
That's true. Jim Eichelberger was, yeah.
Okay. And I think you referred to them as, or somebody did, as three people just out of a Graham Greene novel.
Exactly. These guys landed together. Kearns was hired by CBS in 1953 through a request by an old friend of his from Eisenhower's office in London, a guy named Edward Sachs. He was a captain and an aide to Eisenhower. And Kearns had written previously, was the ghostwriter for Kay Summersby's book, Eisenhower Was My Boss. In fact, it was Kearns who suggested that title, as opposed to the working title was His Girl Friday.
Oh.
And they thought the other title, Eisenhower Was My Boss, was a better title. And so he was known to Ed Sachs as being a good, reliable reporter and a good writer, and they needed somebody in Cairo because at this time, as the communist threat and the Cold War was starting to heat up in 1953, there was the threat of spreading communism, and one of the hot spots was Cairo. Nasser had just come to power there, and they needed somebody. And so Kearns arrives about the same time as Jim Eichelberger, who was later to become the station chief for the CIA in Cairo, and then Miles Copeland, who was signed under a cover of Booz Allen Hamilton as a consultant, and his job was to help structure the Department of Interior for Nasser's new government. So these three guys who had lived together as investigators during World War II were now together once again in Cairo. Is that coincidental? Don't know. But they came together in Cairo and became instant friends. What I found to be odd was that Kearns went there with a small stringer's contract, meaning that he was a part-time reporter, not a correspondent, not a full-time reporter, but a part-timer.
All right, when you say stringer, that's a term that's probably not used very much anymore. So let's go a little bit more into detail. You said you're part-time, but you don't have any regular assignment.
That's right. You create your own work. And or if the network needs coverage in Cairo, you get an assignment from a foreign editor. And that's what Kearns was there for. And he was married at the time. He had a war bride and a young son. And the other thing he carried with him into Cairo was a contract to write a book called Modern Egypt. But the interesting thing about the contract was there were no financial terms in it. It was just a contract to write a book.
And that was for Prentice Hall, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And a very reputable publisher.
A reputable publisher, but like Booz Allen Hamilton, also a known cover for the CIA.
So we've got Kearns in Cairo in the 50s now. What did he do between the end of the war? He got out of the service. Was he staying in England at that time?
He was in England, and then he came back to the United States, got himself an agent, and began writing magazine articles for the prominent magazines at the time. And the Wanderlust really, or Wanderlust, I guess is the right term, really set in, and he wanted to get back to England. He liked being in that environment. His wife was from England, and so he did. He packed up his bags and moved off.
Did he take his family with him?
He did. He did. And so while he was in England, he did a variety of freelance assignments, and along came Ed Sachs, his old friend from Ike's offices, who said, "How would you like to go to Cairo?" But Kearns went to Cairo, and they began opening bureaus in Japan and in Southeast Asia and wherever they thought the influence of communism was going to be. They knew that was going to be a hot spot, and so CBS would have radio reporters there. But a year after being on the ground and filing radio reports, Kearns filed his first television report in 1954. So he'd only been there a year.
And this report was an interview with Nasser, was it not?
That wasn't the very first one.
That wasn't the first
one. But that was among the first.
Okay. Well, let's talk about trying to the equipment and how really difficult it was to do video, or actually it was film in those days compared to today, where if somebody wants to cover a story, they can do it on their phone and email it to their boss and that's it. That wasn't the case back in 1954.
When Frank Kearns was in Cairo, it was 16 millimeter film, very big cameras, heavy, clunky. There was a sound man that had to be brought along because it was a separate piece of film, if you will, tape. And it wasn't easy to get around. And also to do interviews. You know, we take telephone communications today for granted. In Kearns time, if you wanted to make a long-distance phone call, you would go to the desk of the hotel you were staying in and make a reservation. And that reservation was most likely going to be a day or two away. And if you weren't there at the appointed time, you had to come back and make another reservation. So just communications other than telex was very difficult.
All right, explain to our folks what telex is.
Well, telex was a point-to-point communications device with the, if you've seen the film All the President's Men, you know, right at the very end, you see the telex machine typing out news reports. And that's the way people communicated. In fact, in 1975, when I was at CBS News in Rome, sending communications back and forth to New York was still largely by telex.
All right. So what was this first interview that he did?
It was a softball interview regarding some antiquities that had been discovered. But they wanted to see how he would do. He was lucky, though. He hired as his cameraman a guy named Yusuf Masraf. Joe was an Egyptian who, they called him Joe, was an Egyptian who, as it turns out, was Nasser's photographer. So he had the inside track to the Egyptian government. He was very, very talented as a photographer, as a cinematographer, and many people have told me he was a raconteur. He was the kind of guy you wanted to go on assignment with. He was hard to work for, but he was an extraordinary conversationalist and an excellent chef.
All right, so he did get the guy who's now his boss a taped interview with Nasser.
That's right. And it was the first time any of the networks had any insight into what Nasser was thinking and what he was doing. And if you go back and listen to the interview, Kearns asks pretty tough questions. It's also interesting to note that in that first interview, Nasser pulled Masraf aside before it got started, and he said, "You know your guy is CIA." And Masraf dismissed it. But that's what Nasser had been told by his folks. That recognition wouldn't come back again for quite some time.
About his being CIA.
That's right.
But yet, even though Nasser knew that, he gave a, you know, as you said, asked hard questions, and the answers were pretty frank. I mean,
they really were. It was a good interview, and the guys back in New York said, you know, we've got a real pro on the ground over there. And so more and more stories were being requested for television as well as for radio. And it moved along at a pretty good pace where he was out in the field quite often covering events in North Africa and the Middle East. And it leads us up to 1957 when he was asked to go to Algeria.
I think folks may not remember, but he's in Egypt, but the entire Mediterranean coast of Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, in 1950, with the exception of Egypt, they were all part of a colonial empire.
That's true. What was happening, though, were those countries were being given their independence, mm-hmm. except for Algeria.
Libya had belonged to the Italians, but then Morocco and Tunisia both gained their independence, and there were two Moroccos, Spanish and French, but the French gave Tunisia and Morocco, French Morocco, their independence, but not Algeria.
Not Algeria. It was important as an agricultural base and was considered in many ways part of metropolitan Paris.
And that there were about 2 million Frenchmen living in Algeria.
Oh, yeah. The coastline is beautiful, and the cost of living was less. Jobs were plentiful, and they were pushing out the Algerians. It was a dangerous place. It became a dangerous place because the French would not give them independence, and those with whom they did give some freedoms, they tended to be the upper-class Algerians. And 98% of Algeria was Berber.
So at some point, people in Washington realize that this is going to be another fiasco for the French. They've already lost Vietnam, 54.
They had lost Vietnam, and they lost the Suez. They had joined the English to try to get control of the Suez Canal, and they all plotted with the Israelis, and one thing led to another, and it was firmly in the hands of Nasser and the Egyptians. And so the French were having a tough time, and they didn't want to surrender the economic benefits of having Algeria as part of its little empire, what was left of it.
Well, the United States played a big role in the canal. I mean, British paratroops had actually landed the Israel. I mean, they had seized control of the canal, and Eisenhower refused to back them up.
Well, that's right. And that's what really brought Senator John Kennedy to the foreground on foreign affairs. He said it was time that the Eisenhower administration stopped its head-in-the-sand policy regarding Algeria and the Maghreb, the northern African coast.
So CBS decided to tap Frank Kearns to find out what was going on behind the lines. In this case, not the French story on Algeria, but the Berber story of Algeria. And the rebel armies had, they were FLN, and they had several different names. I'm going to let you pick up that.
Well, that's right. The Algerians had decided they had had enough, and they began a very sophisticated movement to win back control of their country. They had put a full court press on at the United Nations to be recognized as the official government of Algeria. And this is the FLN, the Federation for Nationalism. And they had their own army that they had recruited that were based in the Arras Mountains. And they were determined not to let the French control their destiny, because around them, Libya and Morocco, as you said, had been freed. And so this was their time. But it was not an easy struggle. The French put up terrific resistance to any form of takeover that the Algerians had tried. And it was interesting that they used as the system for getting their weapons their membership in NATO. The United States was providing, under NATO treaties, defensive weapons for France, and they were transferring a great deal of that to Algeria and using it offensively.
Well, this, of course, began and it really continued as a guerrilla warfare.
It was. It was not a safe place to be. And it looked like it was going to blow up. And the concern was that the Soviet Union might want to play a hand. The U.S. government couldn't get their own handle on whether or not the Soviets were stirring the pot and helping to fund and provision the Algerian Liberation Army.
And they were suspicious of, Nasser was playing with the Russians.
Nasser played both sides of the fence. He was willing to take our money, but he was also willing to tell us where we could put it.
Well, there is a Paris bureau for CBS, so they're getting the French side of this. And it wasn't long before the French were putting out the line that it's, of course, a communist insurgency.
Exactly. The American public, through CBS News and other newspapers and television and radio, were just really hearing one side of the story. And Ralph Paskman, who was the longtime foreign editor for CBS News, was working with a team to develop four stories about the Middle East. They were concerned that the Middle East was not going to be a place where good things were going to happen, and in fact, most of it was going to center around the oil fields. Mm-hmm. So they had come up with a series of documentaries back in the days when real documentaries, meaningful documentaries, kind of like Frontline on PBS, were being produced for network television. And they came up with these four stories, and at the last minute, Ralph Paskman suggested another idea. Why don't we put a reporter behind the lines with the Algerians so we can test what we're hearing, what we're seeing in the photographs being shot from the other side? So he sent a telex to Frank Kearns and said, you know, we want you and your cameraman, Joe Masraf, to go across from Tunisia and spend 5 or 6 weeks and report on what you discover.
Now, sounds like a great adventure, yes, dangerous. But Kearns is not really a young stud at this point. I mean, he's in his 40s.
That's right. But he was a strong patriot, you know, having like many of the reporters who grew out of World War II, they had a sense of country and a sense of duty, and the good reporters had an inquisitive mind. And despite the fact that he had a wife and son in Cairo, he said, "Yeah, we'll do it." And he turned to his two good friends, Copeland and Eichelberger, and he said, "How can you help me to make the right connections?" And they did. And so they sent them off to Tunis, and they spent what they thought was just going to be a couple of days getting acclimated and meeting people turned out to be probably a week there as well. And so they spent that time walking as much as they could because they were going to walk all the way into the mountains of Algeria where the fighting was going on. But to get there, they had to cross the no man's land between Tunisia and Algeria.
And the French got word that there were American journalists going to be, and today we'd say, embedded with the rebels.
That's right. And so there were missions sent out, airplanes and troops to find these Algerians with their cargo. And as you said earlier, technology was very different then. They left Tunis with 400 pounds of gear that they were going to walk into the mountains.
These two men, Kearns and his photographer.
Kearns and his photographer and a small troop of Algerian soldiers were going to walk across no man's land and up into the mountains and try to be safe with 400 pounds of gear and a couple of donkeys and a group of men carrying it all.
Jerry, we're going to have to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Jerry Davis, the author of an exciting book, Algerian Diary. And it's about Frank Kearns, and before we took that identification break, he and his cameraman and a small group of Algerians were crossing no man's land from Tunisia into Algeria. So let's pick up the story there.
Algerian Diary came to my attention through a box of materials that Kern's second wife, Sarah, sent to me. She said we had a meeting one time in 2003, and she said, I think it's time for you to do your story. And I said, you know, my story was 1975, and I don't have quite the resources I had at my disposal then, but I'll see what I can organize. And so I spent a couple of years doing research and talking to people who knew Kearns and came to the conclusion that there was enough there that I could do a documentary film about Frank Kearns.
And that's what you had started off to do.
That was going to be my 1975 master's project until Kearns put his foot in my back and said, get out of here.
Yeah. And so you did produce a documentary for television.
I did. It's called Frank Kearns, American Correspondent, and it's not quite a bio, but it's a good look at someone who I thought had a good story to tell about being a journalist at the start of television news and all the way into the corporatization of news, when Paley was starting to step out of the picture and Lowe's Corporation was starting to step in. So it spans 1953 to 1971, which was Kearns' career.
When you started putting together this documentary, there was a documentary that Kearns had done, Algeria Aflame. Did you have access to that?
I did. I made a special request to the library at CBS News. And they assembled, because it was in bits and pieces, as best they could, Algeria Aflame. There was no narrator. There was no music. There were no credits. But there were most of the elements of this film that won for Kearns the George Polk Award for Courageous Reporting, the Overseas Press Club for Best Foreign Reporting in Radio and Television, and several other awards, and it was disappointing to see what had become of this award-winning film. But nevertheless, it had a tremendous amount of impact on American thinking, particularly at the government level. So I was pulling together this documentary, and I ran across these little notebooks. Sarah had sent me a box of these tiny little notebooks, and I recognized them from my time working for Kearns as an undergraduate, that as it turned out, it was the foundation documents for Kearns' book that he was planning to write called Algerian Diary. It wasn't much longer that I opened another box, and there was an entirely typed out script called Algerian Diary. And I said, you know, this is, I'm going to weave this into the documentary, but I think there's an opportunity here to make a book.
All right. Why didn't Kearns publish?
Kearns had a terrible time talking about himself. Kearns struggled to put together a book. He was supposed to write about himself, but he just couldn't do it. I think there was something else going on at the same time, however, and that was to come to light in February of 1976. Shortly after Kearns had told me he didn't want to be the subject of a documentary, that was October of 75, by February of 76, I was in his office when the telephone rang, and it was Daniel Schorr at CBS News. He wanted to talk to Frank, gave him the phone, and Frank's face went white, and he signaled me out of the office. Later that night, CBS News reported that Sig Mikkelsen, a former president of CBS News, told the Senate Intelligence Committee that was investigating the CIA and its use of the media that Frank Kearns and another reporter in the 1950s, Austin Goodrich, both worked for the CIA. Now, Kearns denied it right away. He denied it to everybody who asked him about it. He shut it down completely.
Didn't he get lawyers and basically did shut people up?
Well, you know, the first call he made was to a woman that he went to high school with. She worked for the CIA. And she said that she would do what she could do to kill the story inside. The second call he made was to Eric Severide. And Severide was in the Washington Bureau. You know, he was the guy who did editorials twice a week for Cronkite's news program. Mm-hmm. And he was the intellectual within the organization. But he and Eric Severide grew up in the London Bureau together in the 1950s, and they had a conversation that Severide described as being very emotional, that Kearns, he thought, was on the verge of crying. Why would somebody do this to him at this stage in his career? And part of the answer, I think, is that CBS was trying to clear its own decks. They were getting a lot of pressure because of the stories coming out. You know, Carl Bernstein wrote a long article for Rolling Stone magazine about the CIA and the media. And there were questions about some 400 journalists over the years who had been working in cahoots with the CIA in some manner. Not all of them were undercover. Not all of them were getting direct pay, but they somehow would be entangled with the CIA. And I think that's where Kearns came in. I think he was sitting in Cairo with his two old friends from World War II, and the three of them were sharing information. And I'm sure, because I've talked to a few people who seem to know, that Eichelberger and Copeland, that we talked about earlier, were helping him to get into Algeria. And then he could report back to them whatever he discovered, and they would share it back in Washington.
Well, does that make him a spy?
Well, that's a good question. My co-producer Chip Hitchcock and I, for the documentary, debated that for 4 or 5 years. And in fact, we still do when we talk to each other today. Chip was convinced that Kearns was CIA. And I'm not quite that convinced, but there's certainly compelling evidence. And interestingly enough, every year I file a Freedom of Information Act request regarding Frank Kearns and the CIA. And every year I get back pretty much the same form letter signed by whoever is heading the department at the time, saying that they can neither confirm nor deny the information that I'm seeking.
Well, the CIA connection aside, the fact that people in the United States government wanted to find out what was really happening in Algeria as opposed to what was coming out of the Élysée Palace in Paris. They wanted to get what was really going on, and I'm sure they could have sent agents in there, but he was a journalist, and he produced a story, a documentary that CBS aired.
Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine today a reporter for one of the networks being embedded with the Syrians or with ISIS? You know, it's a different political circumstance with respect to ISIS. Algeria here had natives who wanted their country back.
You know, I remember the evening news back in the 1950s, and I must say, I think most of what we really got in the early 50s certainly was the Paris story. The heroic French paratroopers, the Foreign Legion, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And that was the whole point of sending Kearns behind the lines with the Algerians. You know, what's the story from their point of view? How do they recruit? How do they get their weapons and their ammunition? Are they being funded or supported in any way by the communists? And what's the likelihood that they can outlast the French? And the answer to all that was that they were very well organized. They were not just a political force at the UN, but they also were a military force. And but for the Americans providing NATO-related munitions, it's very likely that they would have gotten, the French would have gotten shoved out earlier.
And of course, eventually, Algeria caused the collapse of the Republic, the French Republic. De Gaulle comes in and makes his peace to evacuate, which almost cost him his life.
It did. I mean, it was a dangerous time to be French. There was a group called the Red Hand. There was also the White Hand, but there was the Red Hand, which was a group of French mercenaries and operatives whose job it was to ferret out where the supplies were coming from and blow them up. This went from Morocco to Hamburg. Wherever they found ships that they suspected were destined with weapons to go to Algeria, they made it their business to see that it didn't happen. Wherever they could find the weapon flow, they went after it. And you know, that's, if you think about the Algerian war at the time, it has some similarities to a more recent war. Here are the French who were willing to declare war on their people, and they were willing to use torture to get to the leadership. On the other side were the Algerians who, in order to get the attitude and minds of the people turned in their direction, were willing to blow up cafes and do things that would strike terror in the hearts of people, and they would blame it on the French. So you had two different ways of approaching this domestic war, and they came in surprising ways. I mean, the French believed in torture, and they were ruthless about it. And the Algerians believed in sabotage of civilians in order to get their minds straight.
Well, those who study guerrilla warfare, partisan war, whatever you want to call it, this sort of a cardinal rule is that no matter who causes the damage in terms of sabotage, if you can prove that the government in charge can't protect the people, then the rebels, the guerrilla, will always win.
It's an interesting perspective.
That's, you know, the main object of a country is to keep its peace and protect its people. If you can't do that, if the government can't do that, the other side's got a good chance of winning.
You know, it was happening all over Africa. Countries were winning their independence or earning their independence. And what became very apparent was they didn't care about the communists. They didn't care about the United States, which obviously was our interests. They cared about their own safety and security first. Mm-hmm. But, you know, from our perspective, we made it us against them, and you're either with us or against us. And it didn't play out very well in every circumstance.
Well, now, Kern spends, what, 6 weeks in the mountains?
Yes.
All right. And he comes back, and does he come back with the documentary to the States?
No, no. When they got, he and Joe Masraf got out of Algeria, they ended up at the Excelsior Hotel in Rome. Kearns was a very sick man. Masraf had already been sick. While out in the mountains, he passed kidney stones.
Ooh.
Having been a kidney stone sufferer myself.
Me too. I mean, golly, Moses.
Yeah, how would you like to be lying on the ground in the mountains and going through that while you have to be quiet because there are French soldiers all around? Well, it's just not easy. But they ended up in the Excelsior Hotel, and while Frank was being tended to by doctors, Masraf had gone to package up tens of thousands of feet of raw exposed film that had not yet had a chance to run through the processing, plus the tapes. Plus, Kearns had, along the way, he had a little typewriter with him, and he typed up scripts and notes for the editors back home to assemble. I cannot imagine, having once been a film editor, I can't imagine getting all of that in a series of boxes and have to make something of it in a couple of weeks in order to get it on the air. It was an extraordinary effort by the people in New York, but they had gotten the French side, which was the purpose of Algeria Aflame, tell the French story and tell the Algerian story.
So both sides were in the documentary?
Yes.
It was an hour, right?
Yes. The first half was French, and the second half was Algeria. And it was bits and pieces of notes that had been assembled in the mountains under hot, humid, dry conditions. And they got packaged up, sent back to the editors, and they made an award-winning documentary.
I was going to say, what was the impact of that film on the American public?
The American public saw Algeria in a different light, and the government began to take issue with the French government. Can't use our NATO-supplied defensive weapons for your offensive purposes there. And they were pretty adamant about it, and pretty soon American diplomatic policy changed in favor of the Algerians. As Kennedy said, we can't be talking about independence and democracy on the one hand and be willing to stand by and watch the Algerians be repressed. They want their independence. It's been a separate country going back hundreds of years. And, you know, the French moved in the 1800s and never left. Mm-hmm. They just kept growing in their influence. But American foreign policy changed right after that. Now, is there a direct correlation? I never found anything in writing that said, thank you, CBS, for opening our eyes. Mm-hmm. But clearly, you could see the foreign policy change afterwards.
Well, an hour documentary in those days literally was almost an hour of film. It wasn't broken up every 6 minutes by a commercial. But we need to kind of wrap Kern's career up here. After Algeria, he stayed with CBS. He became the Africa bureau chief.
Yeah, he stayed in Cairo until 1962 when Nasser and his government began to censor reports out of Cairo. At that point, Kearns moved back to London and was based there for the rest of his career. They debated when he was named in 62 as the Africa bureau chief. They debated on where to locate that bureau. And, you know, there was talks about doing it in Salisbury, middle of the continent, down in...
Rhodesia.
Yeah. And down in Johannesburg and someplace in the north if they could, you know, get Cairo to cooperate. And the memos going back and forth between CBS and Frank Kearns is really good reading. But ultimately they said, you know, just because countries are 1 inch or capitals of countries are 1 inch apart on a map as you look at it, if you're going to go from one country to the next, you still have to connect back through Europe. You know, if Frank Kearns was in Tanzania and needed to get to Kenya, he would connect through London.
All right. When did he leave CBS and go to West Virginia?
He left in 1971. He was negotiating a new contract with CBS, and they had a great idea for him, Vietnam. And he said, you know, for the last 17 years, I have been covering wars, civil wars, disasters of all types in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. The last thing I want to do is go to Vietnam. And in fact, he had recommended Morley Safer to be the guy to go there, and Safer made his career because of that assignment.
And so Kearns spent the rest of his career teaching journalism at the University of West Virginia.
He did. He was there until 1983. He retired and moved to Sardinia. He loved being on the Mediterranean and wanted to be near old friends and was staying in the home of a former CBS senior producer. And it was there that he was diagnosed with oral cancer. And you can imagine for a person who made his livelihood using his voice that it was not a good situation. And so he spent 3 years and finally succumbed in 86.
Well, he's moved to Sardinia, and this is out of a Graham Greene novel. He's still married, not divorced. He has met Sarah, who does become his wife, but he was also involved with a former Israeli lieutenant. He's got three women at the same time. Eventually, he does divorce. He drops the Israeli lieutenant, and he and Sarah get married. But I just thought, man, you really did complicate your life.
Yeah, he fell passionately in love with the Israeli woman, Varda Ackerman, and they traveled. She was younger than him significantly. When they met, she was 19. He was 42. And when he met Sarah, she was 22. She was a British Airways hostess. He had taken his son on holiday to Bermuda. And I was just with Sarah in Kenya, and she was recalling for some other people how she met Frank Kearns. And, you know, she said, here was this Adonis who had walked out of the ocean, and she just couldn't help but fall in love. Even his office manager, when I was interviewing her for the documentary, I said, tell me about the first time you met Frank Kearns. This woman lit up. Her name is Patricia Burney. She's a wonderful woman who I met first in 1975 in Rome. And Patricia said it was like having a Hollywood actor walk into the offices. He was so handsome. And as it turns out, over the course of Kearns' career, she was like Moneypenny to his Bond.
Oh, okay. Jerry, any last words before we sign off?
Frank Kearns was a really intelligent and thoughtful guy. This was before the star system of television news. You know, it's a different world today. These were lightweights. I remember standing next to Frank Kearns in, I think it was 74 or so. Tom Brokaw had come to our campus. He was White House reporter during the Watergate years, you know. And he was making a big presentation in an auditorium, and I was standing next to Kearns. And at the time, Kearns didn't think a lot of Tom Brokaw. He probably today would say, you know, this fellow really matured and got smart. But he turned to me and he says, lightweight. And I always remember that every time I tuned into the NBC Evening News, I was watching this so-called lightweight. But over time, I mean, I certainly changed my opinion from that to being a pretty serious journalist. But Kearns was, he was the kind of guy who wanted to hear your story. He didn't want to talk about himself. And he made that very clear, whether you were in the classroom, whether you were in an audience, or if it was just one-on-one. He taught me to drink scotch.
I think that is a good way to end this particular story. Frank Kearns, a very interesting American reporter. And Jerry Davis, thank you for being with us today on The Journal.
Thanks for your interest.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. The conversation with Jerry Davis was fascinating, whether talking about one of America's great journalists from the 1950s, Frank Kearns, what it took to produce a television broadcast in the 1950s, to the whole issue of the Cold War and America's involvement in Africa, Southeast Asia, as colonial empires were collapsing. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.